coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Everybody, how you doing this evening? Chris Jordan here, host of The Curious Realm. Welcome to episode 21. Man, I have been looking forward to this. We have just passed Shakespeare's birthday and death day, and as we are prone to do, we celebrate such days by talking about such topics. Our guest this evening is the amazing researcher and member of the Shakespeare Fellowship. It's actually a group of researchers out there who research the actual topic of Shakespeare as we know him may not be the gentleman that we know, the guy from Stratford von Avon. He may be somebody totally else. So we are going to be exploring that topic. She is the author of Shakespeare Suppressed. We will be talking to the amazing Catherine Children about her work and her research, about her new research for an upcoming book, all kinds of things. We will be getting into the whole authorship question. And folks, you may be thinking like, Chris, what are you talking about? Wait, man, there are people that go back to like Mark Twain didn't even believe that Shakespeare was Shakespeare. This is nothing new. This is a controversy that has been going on for years. Of course, we've mentioned the works of William Shakespeare before in our episodes talking about not only this, but the Curse of Oak Island and the fact that that is one of the many things reputed to be at the bottom of the well of the treasure shaft on Oak Island is the actual original works of William Shakespeare. And we will be getting into the fact of there is not a single original work of Shakespeare at all to be found. So we'll be getting into all the evidence that's actually very, very insurmountable to the fact that William Shakespeare may not be the gentleman that we know and adore on the day of William Shakespeare's birthday and death. So we'll be getting into that with Catherine Children. In the second part of the episode, we will be joined by our good friend and legal correspondent, J.L. Carpenter, to discuss the recent case here in Houston, or here in Texas, rather, about Maria Lucia, or Melissa Lucia, rather, who was the Texas mother who was set for execution, which actively yesterday she was given a stay by the senators, everything else. They were able to petition for her to get a stay. She has gotten a stay of execution as of right now. But even the controversial Reed technique that we talk about in our upcoming part with J.L. Carpenter, folks, if you have never been arrested, if you've never been put before the man in a chair and had them sweat you down, let me tell you, it's an experience that you've missed. And some good people like Maria Lucia, who was used, had this Reed technique used on her, the literal worst case scenario of good cop, bad cop that you see in the TV and movies. Horrible, horrible things came from this, and we may have almost executed a literal innocent person right here in the state of Texas. I am no fan of the death penalty, nor is JL. My audience knows my political leanings. Doesn't really matter. I'm just not a fan of it. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And we'll get into a lot of the legal reason why it doesn't make sense to continue that program in the United States and in states. We'll be getting into that and so much more with J.L. Carpenter. We'll also be talking about the mad circus that has been the recent Facebook trial the literal trial of Johnny Depp and Amber Heard being broadcast live on Facebook and what that means for the future of law. And speaking of Facebook, let's go check out our news of the week, folks. News of the week brought to you by the Curious Realm Facebook group, now right at 900 members. At a straitstimes.com, China reports the first human case of H3N8 bird flu. USA Today, flight attendants generally don't start getting paid until the plane doors close. Delta is about to change that. That one blew my mind to read that, because I travel a lot, and it never dawned on me that, yes, they are flight attendants. Why would you pay them while they're on the ground? But that's a little ridiculous, because it's not like you don't pay a customer service person when the phone ain't ringing. At insider.com, son of a cult leader, Warren Jeffs describes life on a Texas ranch where he had to call 15-year-old girl's mom. At a CNBC, at least 58% of U.S. population now has natural antibodies from previous COVID infections, say the CDC. And at a mirror.uk, Chinese police build cages around homes in world's strictest COVID lockdown. Just some of the amazing things that we bring to you on Facebook there every week, folks. Stop on by, check it out, join the group. We now have over 3,000 followers. My favorite thing is that we have more followers than likes to our page, which means more people actively want to know what we're doing and when we're doing it than they care about just liking us, which is really, really awesome. So thank you to everybody that follows the page. Thank you to everybody who checks that out, because you get to hear about exclusive things like the upcoming Bigfoot Roadshow, the Southeast Texas Bigfoot Roadshow, coming to you in Mineola, Texas, this upcoming Saturday, folks. I am holding in my hand not only numerous copies of the itinerary, but also my actual, I'm so old school, I still print things like a hotel reservation. If that didn't belie my age. But yes, I have reservations for one of the most haunted hotels in the state of Texas, and I cannot wait to stay there. Hopefully we'll be able to interview the owners of that fantastic place, the Beckham Hotel. But for those of you who have been following the show, make sure to tune in. You can tune in anytime you like right on CuriousRealm.com. CuriousRealm.com is where you can go to find everything Curious Realm, including our live feed. You can see right there that we are live as we speak on the live feed. And in addition to that, speaking of live feeds, thank you so much to our sponsor of our live feeds, WebWorks Wireless. WebWorks Wireless is where you want to go if your family's out in the country, out where maybe you don't have landline, anything like that, to be able to get internet. But you need internet for everybody in your house. You need to be able to watch the Hulus. You need to be able to Netflix it and get the Blippi for the kid, things like that. WebWorks Wireless is where you want to go, folks. www.webworkswireless.com. I am here to tell you, I have yet to hit a cap. When they say unlimited, Bubba, they ain't playing. I easily put up 20 gigs of data a month live streaming this show in 720p. I can't imagine what it would be if I was streaming it in 1080. But just in 720p with the content that we put out every month and with what I upload when I'm on the road, using this thing to benchmark it for them, I'm at 20 gigs upload a month and have yet to hit a speed cap. So stop on by, check them out, WebWorks Wireless. While you're there, make sure to check out the website of our other sponsor that we picked up lately, Secret to Everything, the amazing Dr. Kimberly McGeorge, secrettoeverything.com. Stop on by. They are your number one source for alternative health, frequency healing, and consciousness shifting. And man, talk about shifting consciousness. We are about to shift gears from the shameless pitch machine that I am to somebody who's just enthralled with the fact that William Shakespeare, one of the greatest artists and authors known to mankind, may not be the man that we know. And I remember the first time I heard this, probably about 20 years ago. It was drunkenly over a few drinks, just talking hardcore philosophy, things like that. And someone was like, well, you know, William Shakespeare's a lie, so you never know. And man, that begat something in my life that was like, no, this can't be. And when I met Catherine Children, or children, excuse me, and ran across her research in her books. Man, like I've said with you before, Catherine, if I were a DA, I wouldn't prosecute the case. There is nowhere near anything but surface evidence that the man we know as William Shakespeare, the man from Stratford von Avon, is William Shakespeare, the man who wrote all these works. So welcome back to the show, Catherine Children. How are you today?
I'm doing well. It's so great to be back, Christopher, and to discuss the greatest mystery in literature.
It is, once again, a mind-numbing thought. And, you know, we talk regularly on this show about the science of religion, about the fact that, you know, the whole purpose of science is to question everything, even science. The day you stop questioning, it's now a doctrine. It's no longer science, you know? And so much it is the same way with literature, that what the interpretations are what they are, and they are not to be questioned.
Yes, it's been that way for a few hundred years now, but it's really, like you said, it's all about evidence, and there is no evidence to prosecute the Stratford man as the man who did it,
yeah,
if you want to put it that way, because the main reason is there's no lifetime evidence that he was educated or that he wrote anything or that he was a writer. All we have is evidence that he was a member of an acting company, but that's not writing, right? And that he owned theater shares, you know. So he was definitely, the man from Stratford-on-Avon was definitely involved in the theater, but there is no lifetime evidence that says he's an author. It's all posthumous. When 7 years after he died, they made it look like he was the great author. And Shakespeare professors know this to this day. They know there's no lifetime evidence connecting their man to the Shakespeare works. And they know that they can only rely on the evidence after he died. And, you know, that is not evidence at all. You need both. And
yes,
this is why this problem attracts a lot of lawyers, because it's all about the evidence, and many Supreme Court justices have been interested in this topic. In fact, in the Wall Street Journal about 10 years ago, they interviewed various ones, and several of them, at least three or four, doubted the Stratford man as the great author. So this is not just a, you know, woo-woo topic. It's a very serious topic, and it deserves attention and recognition, which the only people who won't give it are the Shakespeare academics. So,
yeah.
But everybody else says there's a problem. Every other discipline, history, philosophy, you name it, doctors, lawyers, they're all into this.
And like I said in the intro, even it goes back to people like Mark Twain. Like, this is not any kind of new. I was trying to find out where can people go to, A, sign the petition, because there is an
active
petition.
Oh, yeah, that's
petition.
A great website.
B, I want to show the people, because you literally have an entire list of people who have questioned the veracity of the claim that the man from Stratford von Avon is the man that wrote all these works.
Yes, the website is doubtaboutwill.org. Doubtaboutwill.org, and you can read the Declaration of Reasonable Doubt, and you can sign the petition, and you can see everybody else who've signed it, including a couple famous people, or, you know, well-respected list
I'm on
of
there.
People. Well, there you go.
I mean, that's
number
as famous
one.
As you can get.
Yeah.
I'm an award winner.
That's right. And back to Mark. And back to Mark Twain, he wrote a book, Is Shakespeare Dead? And it was this was in 1909. So, and it was all about the authorship question. And this is a great quote from him. He said, The Stratford man's case is like a reconstructed brontosaur. 9 bones and 600 barrels of plaster and Paris. Paris.
Yeah. And for those of you that may not catch that reference, I actively own a T-shirt that, bless you, my brother Randy, he begat my snarky T-shirt collection, but it was just a picture of a brontosaur that just said, never forget.
Huh.
And people were like, what's that mean? And I'm like, well, technically it should mean you should never forget that the brontosaurus never existed. And that would it opened so many conversations like that where they're like, what? And I'm like, look it up, dude. The brontosaurus never existed. It was a bunch of parts that were found near each other that they made fit.
Wow. Yeah.
That they made fit and said, this is a brontosaur. And not really the case. There are many, many animals like a brontosaur out there. But that brontosaur as we know it, yes, is false science, fully. It's like now saying that Pluto is a planet. Nope, it's a planetesimal. Like, Pluto isn't even on my son's astronomical chart in his room. Not even on there anymore. Yeah. I grew up with it as a planet my whole life. So, we need to be as flexible as we are with things like that when it comes to Shakespeare. And I myself, you know, as we've had the conversation before, I went to a liberal arts university and have quite a few, we read a lot of classics, and a lot of the theater was Shakespeare. And to bring this topic up to a lot of people, it's just shut down immediately. But let's start laying the case. I'll kind of springboard us here with the fact that something that I just recently learned, even despite our hours of conversation, Catherine, is that Edward de Vere's literally prime suspect number one for being William Shakespeare within the court of England was known as the Spear Shaker.
Well,
because of
his
prowess in jousting.
That's right. That's right. He won 2 jousting tournaments. So the earliest when he was 21. So he was, a spear shaker for sure. And he adopted, I would say, this as a pseudonym. And not too long after that, a few years after that, someone addressed him in public with the Queen present, Queen Elizabeth I, and all her courtiers, and the Earl of Oxford was there. And so this writer, Gabriel Harvey, he talked to him in Latin, gave a speech praising the Earl of Oxford as an excellent writer. And he said, thy will shakes spears. You can interpret it that way in Latin. So I think that he already had this pen name pretty early on. But he was also known to write anonymously or with a pen name. People mentioned it. So, and they also mentioned that he was a excellent playwright and poet. We have just a few of his poems when he was very young, maybe in his teens, that are signed by him. But where are his plays? They called him best in comedy. Where are those comedies?
Yeah.
And of course, Arthur he is. We all know them. Comedy of Errors, All's Well That Ends Well, Much Ado About Not, all of those are all truly his.
Well, and, you know, just to springboard off that real quick, why would an earl, somebody that high up, why would they need a pseudonym to write? Like, I write tons. I was an assistant youth minister. I wrote poetry, all kinds of things. Why is it that somebody in the court of England can't just sit around and write things and pen stuff? Why would that be, quote, anathema? Just to play devil's advocate and ask a question.
Yes, the Earl of Oxford, he came from one of the oldest families in England. I mean, his ancestors were, you know, tight with William the Conqueror in, you know, 1066. They were already lords in England. So he had, at that point, there was 400 years history, and he was the 17th Earl of Oxford. So he had a very proud family name. And, of course, this was a very socially conscious society. And you, as a nobleman, you would be expected to do important things for the country, for the queen, like being a general or a counselor or a judge or something, you know, something like that. And, you know, sitting around and writing plays and poems, it was considered a frivolous activity. And even to be involved in the public theater was déclassé. I mean, you don't do that. So he didn't want recognition in his lifetime for this reason. He wanted to protect his family name. But it would have been perfectly acceptable after his death to get full credit. And we have examples of this, of other highly ranked people after they, during their lifetime, nothing is published with their name on it. But after they die, full credit, full publishing, no problem. But that courtesy was not extended to the Earl of Oxford. And that's why we have this problem to this day. We need to find out what was behind it.
And, you know, like I said, I after our many conversations in reading your book, there's no way I myself, if I was a prosecutor, would ever take on the case. The connection of things is way too spurious and almost unsubstantive. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we have no Shakespeare manuscripts, nothing in the man's handwriting. We don't have any Shakespeare images. We don't have any payments to a writer, Shakespeare. We have, even though Queen Elizabeth was known to have seen her plays, of course, at her own royal court, not in the public theater. There's no known encounters between her and the great Shakespeare. There was no notice of his death. So, I mean, you have all these zeros attached to the name William Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. When he was alive, no one claimed to have known William Shakespeare, right? So all you add all this up, and the cumulative evidence suggests, of course, that the name was someone's pen name. So there wasn't somebody named William Shakespeare who went to Cambridge. It was somebody else, somebody using that as another name. And so that's what takes us to the pseudonym, makes perfect sense. And then all you have to do is look at the handful of people who had the type of education and experience and life experiences as the writer displays in his works, like knowledge of Italian and French and the classical languages, and even European geography, intimate knowledge of, you know, towns in Italy. You know, you just astronomy, rhetoric, you know, you just the list goes on and on. And this had to have been somebody who was not only familiar with the aristocracy, but had a most superlative education and who went abroad to Europe.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can really reduce the number of people who that would be. And the Earl of Oxford fits in every category, just like a glove. It's beautiful.
Well, and it's really interesting. Just a second ago, you brought up his extensive travel, whoever it was that wrote these things, because, number one, their knowledge of royal courts, not just the English royal court, but the Scottish royal court and others, is pretty marked for somebody who was so to speak just a regular guy off the street.
Right. That's what they say. Someone of humble origins.
Yeah.
The Stratford man has no connection to, you know, the court or the queen or anything like that. And what do you have, say, in Hamlet? in Hamlet, you have a satire of one of the most powerful men in England, Lord Burghley. He really ran the country with Queen Elizabeth. And here you have supposedly a man of humble origins lampooning Lord Burghley in the role of Polonius, the counselor.
Yeah.
Number one, how would you know how to lampoon him unless you knew him? And number two, how would you survive lampooning him? In a play, a public play. It just doesn't make sense. But again, Earl of Oxford fits perfectly. Lord Burghley was his guardian when he was a teenager, and then he married Lord Burghley's daughter. So he knew him intimately. So it fits. And of course, he's not going to get prosecuted for lampooning his father-in-law, right? So,
yeah. And even to go back to the point of extensive travel, one of the favorite points I like bringing up to people is the one that you mentioned the last couple times you were on, which was actively the Grove of Trees that is mentioned as the secreting away place of Romeo and Juliet in Verona.
Yeah.
In the story of Romeo and Juliet.
In the first act, somebody asks, where is Romeo? You know, we're trying to find him. And somebody said, oh, I saw him at the Western Wall, in the sycamore trees. And we're talking about Verona, right?
Yeah.
And, well, Richard Rowe, one of our great Oxfordian researchers, he took that clue and many other clues found in the Italian Shakespeare plays, right? To try and seek out if Shakespeare really was describing, you know, places, real physical places. And one of them was this with the sycamore trees. And sure enough, he went to the Western Gate wall, and there were sycamore trees there, right? So this is just a tiny detail that Shakespeare, you know, it has nothing to do with the story. It was not in the medieval version of Romeo and Juliet. It was just something the author added in there. And I would say from his life experience of touring Italy.
Wow. Wow. And, things like that, details like that are what I love. And how long have you been working with the Oxford Fellowship? Because you actively just did a presentation with them that went live today. It was a few days ago. But tell us a little bit about this presentation that you just did about the fake folio. This is where, for those of you that don't know, the folio is what we know as the original of the originals of William Shakespeare. They are not by far the actual hand-penned originals, but they are, as far as we know, as far back as we can get, the original text. So tell us a little bit about the fake folio and the presentation that you just gave at the Oxford Fellowship.
Yes, the folio means a large size of paper. So this is a book of, you know, large folio size pages, and there's 900 pages, and the first 15 or 16 pages is the preface, and that's what I discuss in my presentation, how misleading it was. I call it the folio fraud. And this is in these opening pages is what directed us to Stratford-on-Avon to find the great author, which really was a red herring. The phrase Stratford-on-Avon, which is known as the birthplace of Shakespeare today, right? That phrase is nowhere in those first opening pages. And we have a picture of a man, just a gentleman with no signs of being a writer, no like pens or ink pots or books or laurel leaves. That was a common way to depict a poet playwright with laurel leaves in their hair. Nothing. It's just a black and white stark picture of a man with no decoration, really. And they're like telling you in essence that this is a man born with that name, William Shakespeare. They're giving you that impression, this master William Shakespeare. And then a couple pages into it, you have a reference to Avon by another poet playwright, Ben Jonson. He calls Shakespeare Sweet Swan of Avon. And then a few pages after that is another poet referring to Shakespeare and his Stratford Monument. So, you know, one page Avon, one page Stratford Monument, and bingo, the world put two and two together and together and said, oh, he must have come from Stratford-on-Avon, even though the phrase is not in there. Yet there were many towns named Stratford and with Stratford in it, and many towns with Avon in it. But the problem is that there really was a monument to Shakespeare in the church in Stratford-on-Avon.
Let's get into that, because that was one of the most impressive parts of the presentation and something that we had not really presently discussed in previous episodes with you.
This was new information for me,
and I've actively got that frame from the video from your presentation of the sketch of the original monument and then the monument as it exists. So let's break that down.
Yes. If somebody in 1623, when this folio book of Shakespeare plays came out, if they read it and said, oh, he's in Stratford-on-Avon, I'm going to go there and I want to see this Stratford monument, and somebody actually drew this monument just a few years later in 1634, and it's not the monument that we see today. The monument that we see today is a man holding a pen and paper on a pillow, and he has an upturned mustache and a little goatee. But the original documentary evidence of this monument is a man with a drooping mustache, a full beard, and he's holding a woolsack. It's totally different. So the monument was changed to depict a writer. But in 1623, if you went to Stratford-on-Avon, you'd see a monument to a wool dealer. So, you know, there's something really strange going on here. It was a red herring, really.
Who was, in fact, living in Stratford-on-Avon, an actual person. Like we've said, we are not doubting the fact that there was somebody named William Shakespeare in Stratford-on-Avon.
Yes.
Just the fact that they are not the historic William Shakespeare that we know that wrote all these works.
Right, exactly. He was a living human being, but he wasn't the author. And in fact, the monument in Stratford was to his father, John Shakespeare. Who was a wool dealer. Thus, he's holding a wool sack. And there's another detail, and this is research by Richard Kennedy. He noted that there were leopard heads on the columns of the monument, and the leopard head was the symbol of the town of Stratford-on-Avon. And John Shakespeare was an official, like a bailiff or something. So it would have been proper for him to have a monument with leopard heads on it, but not proper for his son, William, who held no town office. So, it's a setup, you know. They referred to a monument, but it really wasn't a monument to a writer. So it makes you wonder, what did they really mean by Stratford Monument? You know, maybe it was another place. Or maybe it's another term for monument would be a body of writing. So, it's a curious thing.
Yeah.
When considering we don't know where any of the Shakespeare play manuscripts are, maybe it's in a place in a Stratford, one of the, I don't know, maybe a dozen towns named Stratford. How do we know? It's possible.
And continuing on in the presentation, let's get on to the next bit.
A certain point in particular, or
the next point of evidence aside from the statue.
It was basically that was it. The supposed reference to the statue and Stratford and Avon, and basically that's it. And yet there are many contradictions, too, to tell you, also that tells you that this these opening pages are false, like the image, that famous image on the title page of the by Droeschout. You look at it, and you know, besides there being no markings of a writer, everything is unnaturally lit. So you can see two lines under the ear, and anyone can Google this image and see for themselves. Mm. And it's an unnatural second line, and it gives the impression of a mask. And so, like, you can pull the mask off. And opposite that was a little verse written by Ben Jonson, and he tells you, reader, look not on his picture, but his book. So why did they even include this to begin with? And another incredible thing about the opening pages is the dedication to the Earls of Pembroke and Montgomery, which is the first letter. And it's written supposedly by two actors named Hemings and Condell. But the interesting thing is, it's been accepted for over 200 years that it was Ben Jonson who wrote this letter, not the two actors.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, the deeper you go into it, you know, the more false and contradictory it is. So really, the whole thing was, in a way, a fiction. But the rest of the book, you know, the 36 Shakespeare plays was, you know, a great gift to humanity, really, that they assembled and published them. And I'm very grateful Earls of Pembroke and Montgomery. But they also, in a way, were responsible for this fraud of Shakespeare being the Stratford man. But the interesting thing is that one of the earls that the book was dedicated to, the Earl of Montgomery, he was the son-in-law of the Earl of Oxford. He had married his daughter, Susan. Of course, the marriage happened after the Earl of Oxford died in 1604, but he was connected to the family. So, and actually, his brother, the Earl of Pembroke, he was almost engaged to another daughter of the Earl of Oxford. The Earl of Oxford had three daughters, just like King Lear had, think, three daughters, too.
Wow. Wow. And, you know, there are numerous allusions inside of the works of Shakespeare to the life of people like that, to the life of people like Edward de Vere's, to their family connections, that kind of stuff. So it's very interesting that this... And I hate to say facade or charade, because like you said, more than likely the intent was for these things to become public when Edward de Vere, or whoever it was that was the pen master of these.
Yes, he should have gotten credit, you see.
Yeah.
He should have. It was perfectly respectable thing for him to have his works published with his own name on it. But they didn't do it. And here you have his son-in-law being part of the, you know, conspiracy, if you want to call it, to throw the authorship on someone else. And I think that, to do something like that, I think it had to have been political. There were politics behind it. And it certainly had to have been to the benefit of the people that sponsored this book, The Earls of Pembroke and Montgomery. And and I go into that in two chapters of Shakespeare Suppressed, my book. But you know, they probably thought it wouldn't last very long, you know. But look, it's been 400 years and people are still believing it. So well, I think it's time to, you know, start to bring the truth out, and people are going to find the plays so much more interesting, and the sonnets. I mean, the sonnets are like, he is the man speaking himself about his love and his life, and you know, he even seemed to have known that he was not going to get credit. If you look at one of his sonnets, he said, he's speaking to the fair youth, and he says, "From hence your memory death cannot take, although in me each part will be forgotten. Your name from hence immortal life shall have, though I once gone to all the world must die." So he knew that he wasn't going to get credit for some reason. And it's kind of painful to read that. And he also wrote, "My name be buried where my body is." So.
Wow. And now let's start exploring why keep it this way? What does it really matter? You know, I don't even understand the, I guess it could be explained as nothing more than emotional attachment and romantic attachment that people have to, okay, well, you know, William Shakespeare, the man from Stratford von Avon, is the one that wrote all these. Does it really matter who wrote them? They were written. The words are still great. They're still amazing. Of course, you want an artist to get their credit and get their due, but it's not like a family is going to get royalties 400 or 500 years down the line.
Well, yeah, it is. On one hand, it is a simple justice. You know, sure. If you wrote Romeo and Juliet, wouldn't you want to get the credit? You know, even 400 years later, I would say yes, I would. But also the plays will come alive when suddenly you have a biography to match them against. Mm. And I remember when I, you know, in college, I would, when I took a course about a writer or a painter or something, the first day you would get the biography of the artist, right? And then they would start matching events, right, in his life to being reflected in the works. You don't have that privilege with Shakespeare studies today because they have the wrong man. There is nothing in the Stratford man's life that's reflected in the works, you see? But what do they say about Hamlet? The Shakespeare professor will tell you, oh, yeah, it's probably the most autobiographical, you know, the most like the man himself. Mm. But what is he? He's a nobleman, you know, a prince. He was a student, you know, university student. His father died suddenly and his mother remarried soon after. Hamlet rewrote a play for royalty, right? And he sponsored players. You know, you just make this list. Well, that doesn't pertain to the Stratford man. You know,
yeah.
But all of those points pertain perfectly to the Earl of Oxford. I mean, it fits like a glove. So, I mean, if you knew the Earl of Oxford's entire life, incredible life, fascinating life, it just comes alive. It's suddenly 3D instead of 2D.
Mm.
And that's what I'm fighting for. I'm really fighting for the people, besides the author getting justice, but for the people who love the works and the plays. They're just going to have a whole different experience.
Well, and that is absolute truth. You know, there's in a modern day analogy would be Behind the Music. You know, things like that from VH1 where you follow like Hall & Oates for a weekend and hear them talk about how the music was made and things like that. And when you get that intimate understanding of where they were in life, where they were coming from, it does give you a much more intimate understanding of the words that they actively pen.
Yes. Yes. And you can learn about his love life, you know, you know, his first wife, in a way, he was forced to marry her. He really, you know, he really didn't. The first marriage date, he didn't show up.
Oh, wow.
The second marriage date, he did, and they did get married. But that's reflected also in All's Well That Ends Well, with Bertram. He was made a ward of the king, so the king had control over his marriage, and he was forced to marry Helena, and he didn't want to marry her. And, you know, here's a perfect parallel right there. And the Earl of Oxford was made a ward of Queen Elizabeth, and she appointed Lord Burleigh to be his guardian. And so Lord Burleigh also got to control his marriage, and consequently, he had to end up marrying his Lord Burleigh's daughter, Anne Cecil. So here's another parallel right there. Another really funny one, in a way, is the bed trick in All's Well That Ends Well. Bertram thinks he's going to bed with one of his mistresses, but instead, his wife switches places in the dark of night.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened to the Earl of Oxford, and this was written in a history book.
Oh,
I think in the 17th century history book noted it. So, you know, it's just like one parallel after the other.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
It really is. And once again, just to go through and see the parallels between the Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere, and what is there for William Shakespeare. It is fascinating. Even like I said, our conversations that we've had in the past, we've discussed him being in the court, him being from a family, only second to the royal family, had never heard the Shakespeare part about being the spear shaker. I forget what documentary I was watching, and it was like, oh, wow. And that was all of 2 months ago, like after we booked this.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow, that's pretty awesome. So there is a wealth of actual, more than contextual evidence that points to the fact that William Shakespeare is not the man that we know and love. I guess the question now, and the question always, is what do we do about that? What do you, like you said, you of course, I mean, I as an artist, if somebody somebody took my work, I would want my fair due from it. I would at least want my acclamation and recognition for the work I had done. So, what do we do? How do we begin to, I guess, open the minds of people to the point of let's research this in a deeper way, in an open way, and understanding that nobody's trying to destroy any history of theater. Nobody's trying to destroy any history of English or literature or anything like that. What are our next steps armed with this information?
Well, the only people who are really holding it up, you know, the hoax of the Stratford Man, are the English professors. So I guess, a good thing would be if you're a student to, you know, question if you're taking a Shakespeare class or, let's get the conversation going. And, you know, read books like mine, and there's many, many others, and there's a lot of videos out there. And, the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, we sponsored research grants for people who, you know, have looked into the authorship and they see a certain angle that maybe has not been explored and they think they can do it, you know, they can apply for a grant. So there's various things. You can watch our conferences, learn more. And basically just get the word out to your friends. I mean, that's what I'm doing. I'm in a,
absolutely,
grateful to shows like yours that give me a voice and to reach your listeners. And hopefully this will turn around and there'll be a whole new era of true Shakespeare research. I mean, there's been a lot of great Shakespeare research over the last 200 years, but
yes.
Unfortunately, when the biography hits, they're in the totally wrong direction.
Yeah.
That's why it would be really an exciting new field to go into when the true author has been accepted.
Well, and, you know, I guess it really comes down to professors that are open-minded enough to hear this as a thesis, you know, because I think that's really probably going to be the easiest way to get any kind of, maybe, possibly, is if it's presented in enough theses, if it's presented in enough master's and doctorate thesis, you know.
Well, unfortunately, there's not many who would accept it.
No.
You know?
No, but
so that's the problem.
Well,
but in the field of history, you know, might be a different story, but in English literature, it's going to be tough.
Yeah.
It's going to be tough.
Well, and see, I find that odd because the whole idea behind thesis is, well, as long as you can defend your thesis, right? Like,
right, but you still have to have advisors, right?
I mean,
to
advise you along the way of your thesis and to, I don't know. It's just, to me, it was always kind of but I'm allowed to theorize anything here. But you have to approve what I can theorize? I just don't get that.
Yeah, I think that's the case, if I'm not mistaken.
So, oh, no, it is. It is.
Yeah.
And like I said, I really think that will probably be the one of the only aha moments, really, is if that happens. You know, I mean, that was that whole, I want to say it was Arthur C. Clarke who got his doctoral thesis with a purely theoretical thing. Like, it did not even exist.
Oh.
And, you know, but because he was able to convince everybody that this thing existed and had the science behind how it existed and everything else, all utterly made up.
Wow.
It was one of those, well, like, you were able to fool every one of us. Seems like you deserve that degree. I may be mistaken. It may not be Arthur C. Clarke, but man, you know, it's going to be really hard, I think, to get it into the halls of academia, but it's something that we have to do and that we have to be willing to try.
Well, I think that, you know, it's gaining, people, it's coming in people's awareness. I think that's rising, and we just have to keep getting the word out. That's all.
Well, and as of right now, the Declaration of Reasonable Doubt of the Identity of William Shakespeare has 4,962 verified signatures, and 839 of those are academic signatories, folks. Those are people with academic degrees, and once again, people who doubted the origin of William Shakespeare and the veracity of the claim that the man from Stratford von Avon was William Shakespeare. Mark Twain, Orson Welles, William James, Paul H. Nietzsche, William James, Henry James, Tyrone Guthrie, Sigmund Freud, Lord Palmerston, Walt Whitman, Charlie Chaplin, Clifton Fadiman, the list just goes on and on. It's absolutely wild. And to know that some of those people were some of the greatest in their field. One of the things that we have been saying, especially over the last 2 years, Catherine, is how fast the dialogue changed in the media from 2017, when we first saw a clip on CNN that Christmas of what we now know to be a UAP, an unidentified aerial phenomenon, and how long it took the media to start using the term UFO denier.
Huh?
Whereas yeah. 2 years before that, the year before that, had you seen the same report, the headline would have been totally different. You know?
Right.
And now everything is flipped on head, and it's the fact of if you don't believe in it, you're the crazy person. So to see that and to know that, yes, it is just that easy. Once again, we don't have to convince the whole world. We just got to convince 1 out of 5.
Ah, yes.
You know, the American Revolution was born out of 20% or less of the standing population of the United States. The other 80% pointed and laughed and snickered and went, "You are a crazy person right now. Stop it." But we all live in the comfort of that 20%.
Yes.
Presently.
That's a great point.
And
yeah, really something to think about.
No different. We don't have to convince or give the evidence evidentiarily to every single person. We only have to get 20%. You don't have to win
helpful.
A trial to hang a jury. Or to get an
right.
acquittal. You know?
Well, it would also be helpful if we could find a Shakespeare play manuscript. Which we don't even have one page.
Let's get into that, because
over 40 plays.
We mentioned that at the beginning, and I want to cover that before we end, because I think that is really one of the biggest points out of all of it. As somebody, as a writer, Catherine, who, you know, I find it very hard to write my poetry or write my song without a pen. I can transcribe it into type later, but it doesn't flow the same for me when I'm typing as when I'm writing. So
exactly.
I have every poem I've ever written. I have every song I've ever written in original handwritten format. Like, I have that. I'm just me. I'm not running a theater company. I'm not writing plays on end, like, to the point of 3 to 4 a year and making
yes,
my living doing so, supposedly.
Right.
You know, yeah,
there are thousands, maybe millions, of 16th century manuscripts that have survived. And, you know, people's notebooks, many letters, partial manuscripts, play manuscripts even, like of Ben Jonson, we have one of his, have survived. You know, and you're talking about one of the most prolific writers of the period, not leaving behind a letter or a piece of a play manuscript at all, just zero. I mean, it's totally illogical. And you know, those play manuscripts have to exist somewhere. So I think that maybe once the world is looking in the right direction, you know, the direction of the Earl of Oxford, maybe we might uncover them.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a really good point. Like, just the fact of you just ain't looking in the right place to begin with. You know?
Yeah.
You're looking for a bone, and what you're looking for is a stone. Like, you're looking for two totally different things here. And just the idea that, once again, somebody had such a body of work. We have original printed playbills from these plays that were posted on the wall outside of the Globe and things like that. But we don't have the original script?
Right.
So that's just strange.
I know. And that's what makes it the greatest mystery in literature.
Yeah. It's hard.
It's easily solved if you accept that we're talking about a pen name and that the Earl of Oxford used that pen name. And let's look in his direction and his descendants. And maybe, you know, if we have an army of people looking in that direction, maybe we'll find something.
Yeah, Yeah.
And we know what the Earl of Oxford's handwriting is like because we have about 50 or so letters of him that have survived.
Mm-hmm.
They're mostly business letters. So we know what his handwriting is like.
And we
can compare it with a Shakespeare play manuscript if one ever comes up.
And then it'll
be over.
What do we have other than, because there is, of course, a baptism registry of William Shakespeare, the man from Avon. There's that.
He was baptized on April 23rd. But we don't know if he was born that day or maybe a couple days before that.
Yeah.
And supposedly he also died on April 23rd.
That's right.
But all we have records of him are his birth, his death, his children's christenings, and him owing taxes, basically.
Do we have him
making loans to people. And then, of course, as I mentioned, he was listed as an actor for the Kingsmen Acting Company, and he was a theater shareholder for two theaters. So he was definitely involved in the theater, but, you know, outside of that, nothing connects him.
As a theater shareholder, is there a signature on record, or is it just an X?
No, he had a signature. We have six signatures of the Stratford man. Three are on his will. One is on the gatehouse near a theater. He bought this property, the Blackfriars Theater, and it was a gatehouse nearby.
So he
has a signature on that.
They're
just property documents, basically, or his will.
Sure, but I'm just thinking forensically, like as long as you got some hooks, some loops, you know, a couple of slants left and right, you should at least be able to identify the veracity of a signature.
That's the problem. They're all different. The spellings are different. They don't resemble each other at all.
Wow.
So we think that he couldn't even hold a pen. He could barely write. If you saw those six signatures, you would think that too.
I would love to see many
signatures of authors back then, and they were beautiful.
Well, and that's
beautiful,
you know, especially somebody
with a little fancy flourish and stuff like that.
Yeah.
This is like someone who could barely hold a pen straight.
Yeah, and especially someone like Edward de Vere, someone like that. We definitely have his signature on record.
Yes, we do.
He was a landholder, a title holder. So guarantee, and had probably sired quite the quarry of children. So I'm sure that his signature was on more than one birth record, things like that. I guess technically what we need once again is an original document to compare that forensic evidence to, of which we have none.
I know. If we could just find one page of Hamlet, I think it'll all be over.
Even a page of the foreword or his personal notes or anything handwritten claimed to be penned by Shakespeare, of which there is none.
Right.
Wow.
That's a mind-blowing point for most people. They can't believe it. That's why
I wanted to end with this point, because it's really the one that makes you go like, what? What? You mean to tell me that, like, you know, here's just a modern equivalent, folks. You know, Stephen King got nothing. He's got a typewriter and a bunch of printed volumes of his stuff. He's got none of his original scribblings or notebooks where he wrote ideas down. Nothing. He's got none of it. Like, just imagine that mind-blowing fact. Like, the man literally had four movies a year for 8 years of the 80s that were written off of his stories. That's a fact. Like, go look it up. It's voluminous. It's the exact same situation to think that Stephen King has zero original manuscript. Zero penned page kicking around his house.
It's impossible.
It's literally impossible. I can't even imagine
it. And it's also impossible that nobody made notice of the great author when he died.
Yes.
If he were the Stratford man, no one said a word about it. And that was a normal thing that other writers would do. They would make tributes.
Absolutely.
No one said a word in 1616.
They would pin a tribute
and
literally pay per letter to have it put in the circular. Things like that. You know,
I don't know if they had those, but usually, fellow writers would make a tribute, or someone would note it in a letter.
Yeah.
Like we have that with Edmund Spenser. He wrote The Faery Queen, and when he died, we have that letter where one letter written to somebody else saying, "Oh, Edmund Spenser died." We have that physical manuscript, right?
Yeah.
Nobody in England or anywhere said anything when the great author died.
Yeah, this amazing author who, to fanfare,
his
had
plays
so,
were extremely popular.
So many successes, and would have, like you said, been privately performed for the royal family, not like, hey, come over to the box in the public theater at the Globe, to have zero mention, zero fanfare at the end of it is rare. That's odd.
It's incomprehensible.
Yeah.
And also, he wasn't buried in Westminster Abbey, supposedly, right? And yet, Spenser was, and Francis Beaumont, Ben Jonson, these were all famous poets of the day, very well respected. And the same thing, supposedly, not for Shakespeare.
Wow.
So it's just curiouser and curiouser.
Wow. Absolutely amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time, as always, Catherine. It is nothing but phenomenal every time I talk to you. The information
it's phenomenal speaking with you, too. You really brought up some great points.
Well,
thank you.
I love your research. I love, once again, just the topic of conversation. You've literally got to be one of the most open-minded people in the world to court the idea that one of the greatest authors in the world is not the person who we think he is.
Right.
And I guarantee you folks get 20% of an open mind and look at 80% of the evidence, and you will be as convinced as I am that this needs to hit it's got to hit the mainstream halls of academia at some point. Even the question of it has to have its credence at some point. Like if anybody's studying a Shakespeare curriculum, if you're not spending a week to a month on the question of is William Shakespeare, I think it's doing even the work of William Shakespeare a disservice.
Thank you. I agree with you.
100%. That's just me as an artist. Like, good God. I would hope that at some point people care enough to look back at my volume of work and go, was that really Chris Jordan? You know?
Yes.
I would hope. And there are good people like you out there that are trying to quite literally bring the man's name to light and give the artist his due. So thank you for that. Thank you for all the work that you do with the Shakespeare Authorship Coalition, that you do with the Oxford Fellowship. Tell everybody where they can go to follow your work, where they can go to sign the petition, where they can go, of course, other than the Curious Realm bookstore to get your books, Catherine.
Yes, well, you can to sign the petition. It's doubtaboutwill.org. To see my video on the folio fraud, you can go to the ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org, and it's under the tab of conferences, past conferences, which it was just 2 weeks ago, or two or three weeks ago. So you can watch my video there. You can go to my website, ShakespeareSuppressed.com, and you can read the introduction to my book. Or you can purchase it there through me privately. You can email me, or you can get it on Amazon. And that's about it.
Wow.
Once again, if you want, it would be wonderful. Go to your public library, and you can give them the ISBN number, which is on my website, and you can say, your library needs this research book about Shakespeare. And
there is a call to,
they'll order it.
There is a call to action. I'll give you a better call to action mission from my audience. Everybody go buy a book and take it to your public library. Donate it to them. Give it to them. Tell them to put it in the Shakespeare section. I'm here to tell you I got it on my bookshelf. I'm highly tempted to go do that with my copy tomorrow, Catherine. Just go take it to the public library down the road and go, can you add this to your Shakespeare section? I would like to donate it and see what happens. Like, I kind of want to videotape it and just go around to public libraries all around and try to give them Shakespeare suppressed to add to their Shakespeare section and see what their reaction is.
Well, that would be awesome. You're a Shakespeare warrior.
Oh, man. The things that go through my head. So, thank you as always, Catherine. I greatly appreciate your time. We'll be sending you a link to this tomorrow, all that good stuff. Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. Take care of yourself. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Wonderful speaking to you again.
All right. Man, I'm telling you, folks, some of the most amazing research out there. It really is a topic that you got to be open mind. You got to be open of heart to be able to even begin to fathom the fact that one of the greatest writers of that we know may not be the man who we think he is. And the more I dig into it, the more I read about it, the every time I have Catherine on, I look into it for at least a good 3-4 days and do some more research. And man, the evidence just points further and further and further away from Stratford von Avon every single time. So, Catherine, once again, thank you for your work. We are going to go ahead and hop to commercial break, folks. When we come back, we will be bringing in J.L. Carpenter to talk about the horrible, horrible case of Melissa Lucio here in Texas, who was set for execution tomorrow, literally at like 5 a.m. She was set for execution. I was going to be waiting up all night long to see what happened from the results of this. She has since gotten a stay of execution. But her means of getting there, folks, is the conversation. There's a reason I didn't call up JL and do an update tonight. It's because we covered the Reed technique and how she got into this predicament to begin with, how she was coerced into her own confession by an interrogation technique. We're going to go into that. We're going to go into the social media circus that has been the Johnny Depp trial and the Amber Heard v. Amber Heard. And what social media live stream trials mean for the future of the American justice system. We'll get into that and so much more right here in part two of our show, folks, when we come back. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHymnScience.com, and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the Internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training. And use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is podcastcadet.com. And we are back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially WebWorks Wireless. WebWorksWireless.com is the website that you want to visit. Stop on by. Check them out, folks. That is who has been sponsoring our live web streams every week to our website. And for events like the upcoming Mineola Bigfoot Festival this weekend, check it out. Stop on by. You can buy tickets, everything else. We have the links there on our website. Make sure to stop on by and follow the live page so that you can keep track of that. Our second guest tonight is the amazing J.L. Carpenter, defense attorney. JLCarpenterLaw.com is the website. We are going to be talking about this case that has actively hit international news. It came by, I remember hearing about the case when it happened, and now this Texas mother is actively set for execution coming up, Melissa Lucio. So let's talk, or Lucio, I suppose. JL, welcome back to the show. How have you been?
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me back. I am excited about this conversation.
Well, it's, you know, we frequently have you on to discuss the topic of wrongfully accused. Whenever we see large cases like this hit the news, that kind of stuff. And when I saw this case pop back up on my radar and I shared it and you commented on it in the Curious Realm group, I was like, man, we got to do an episode on this, because even the concept of the fact that, and there was a whole documentary series that I remember watching about people that were literally coerced into their own confession.
Literally, yeah, it's coerced. Really hard. It's really hard for people to understand the concept of a false confession, because you feel like if I didn't do it, I would never say that I did.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of psychology behind that, but, you know, and that's one of the components in this case, but that's the first thing people think is a false confession. How is that possible? I would never confess to something I didn't do. And it happens all the time. And that's one of the components here in Melissa Lucio's case.
Yeah. Yeah. And precisely the technique specifically used is the Reed technique, which is apparently a fairly controversial technique. It's commonly referred to as, quote, good cop, bad cop.
That's exactly the way that I describe it, is good cop, bad cop. Yeah. And, you know, I think that before we talk about the Reed technique, it's important to know who Melissa is, because she grew up in Harlingen, Texas, and she was a janitor. She had 14 children. She also struggled with drug addiction. CPS was involved in her life with her children a lot. Not for anything violent, though, only for allegations of neglect. And there were times when the children had it better at school than they did at home. They were fed at school. They had hygiene at school, you know, more than they did at home. So, but regardless, everyone has said that, Melissa loved her children. And so you have this mother who is being interrogated, I believe, for 7 hours by two male investigators. And she has a history since she was 7 years old of sexual abuse and physical abuse in the home. And her mom even said that when she came to her at seven and said she was being sexually molested, her mom told her, no, you haven't. Don't ever say that again. And so she was told not to talk about it. And she just endured the abuse. Yeah, at the hands of these older men. So now you've got this emotional mother who just lost her child, who's being interrogated by two strong men for seven hours, I believe. It went into three o'clock in the morning. Never any breaks, no water, nothing to drink, no food. It's emotional. And she finally says, well, then I guess I did it. And so she was a prime candidate for someone who could break easy under the Reed technique. And so going back to the Reed technique, this came up in the 1950s by, a man, I think his name was John Reed, and, he was a Chicago ex-cop, polygraph expert, and he came up with this technique that's got 9 components. And part of it is, you know, they come in pretty strong, and then they give, like you said, good cop, bad cop, they give you alternatives, usually 2 alternatives, and the third is, I didn't do it. So the first is, you committed this crime, or, then they back off, and they give you a more socially acceptable option, like, all right, look, you have 14 kids, you lost it, all right, I understand, so just tell us how it happened.
Yeah, yeah, we can work with you if you work with us.
Right, yeah. So instead of like an intentional, you killed your child, which is horrifying, the other option is, look, we understand it's stressful having 14 kids. So just tell us what happened. How did you think? How did you do it? But in this instance, 100 times or more, she chose option number 3, which was to deny any involvement in this. And she kept saying, I didn't do this. And even leading into trial, they offered her a 30-year option, and she turned that down because she believed in the justice system that she would get a fair trial and they would see the truth that she didn't do this. But anyway, and so, in this case, you know, she finally folded at the end of this long, intimidating interrogation and said, then I guess I did it. And then that was brought into evidence against her at trial. And it's hard to get over a false confession because, again, people who are sitting in judgment think, why would you confess to something you didn't do?
Well, absolutely. A phrase that I use on this show all the time is, yes, conspiracy theories exist, and they put people in jail every day. That's literally the job of a DA, is to take a set of evidence, create a narrative, and walk you down the path of the narrative. That's exactly the point. Where that evidence comes from, what it is, who knows? But that's quite literally their job.
Right.
And to know that when you step into court, the confession is where you start the narrative, not what happened before, not how we got to the confession. We'll talk about that later, guys. You know, you'll hear about that too, but they confessed. Like, that's where you start. And when you start at that point, it's hard to walk it back.
Well, and you mentioned the prosecutor or the district attorney. Now, in this case, at the time that she was being tried, her district attorney, her prosecutor, the elected DA who took on this case because of the, I guess because the newsworthiness of it, he was up for re-election. And then after she was convicted in 2014, I believe, he was convicted federally for accepting bribes and, basically, like, he was hustling with the cartels down there in South Texas, and he was taking money for the dope to go north, and, you know, the money was going south. And, you know, if you wanted a lesser sentence, or if you wanted your probation reinstated, or, if you needed your case dismissed, well, you just had to pay this district attorney, and he made things happen. But if you didn't have resources, if you had to rely on a court appointed attorney, you know, people were intimidated by this man. So, he could run over anyone who was in his path, and she didn't have resources. She didn't have a dream team of legal, defenders, you know, so, she had to work with what the system was providing under those circumstances. And he was at that time, being the district attorney, he was able to get the first Hispanic woman ever on death row in Texas.
Which, you know, it sadly is a big political win, you know. And hearing things like that is horrifying. And even to have talk to the prison reform system, people that we've talked to, the people who work with felons in prison to help them get jobs when they get out, to find out that even that is such an institutionalized part. And the fact of, you know, constituencies are even brought about into the prison population. And the fact of the more people are in there, technically, the more constituents that are voting for the incumbent in office. It's mind numbing, to think about that kind of stuff, and to know that this woman, once again, and I mean, I have the Guardian article up on screen, highlighted right here. Five of the jurors who convinced Lucio, who convicted her have also called for a reprieve. They argued that if they had known at the time what has since emerged, the outcome would have been different.
And then let's talk about what has since emerged, because what I often have to remind, especially brand new young prosecutors, is that not every accident is a crime. And in this case, what she had said going in when she was in interrogation was that her daughter often fell down the stairs of this home that they lived in. And the medical examiner was saying that the child's injuries don't match a child tumbling down these stairs. And there was bruising all over this young baby. And how could it be from one instance? And so it wasn't, her story was not matching what the experts at the time were seeing or, you know, discovering in the autopsy.
Yeah.
But you know, things that did not make it, I don't believe that made it in front of the jury is one, in her CPS records, as many times as CPS was involved with this family, never was she accused of being violent with her children. She never even thanked her children. One of the things was that her children didn't know how to sit down and be well behaved because she was not a disciplinarian. It was always about neglect, and that was because of her drug use. But the other was that this particular child had an awkward gait, and one foot was turned inward, which made it she tumbled down the stairs on more than one occasion, and that was the only way to exit this home. That's how you got in, and that's how you got out of this home. And she had an awkward gait that made it difficult for her to maneuver those stairs.
Yeah.
Also, during the investigation, one of the other children, one of the sons, had told the investigators that he had seen Mariah, is the baby's name, Mariah fall down these stairs. And that was just disregarded. That I don't even think the jury got to hear that part. But when they were doing her appellate work post-conviction, they brought in a different medical examiner, a forensic pathologist from, I believe, Kansas City, Missouri, to go over everything. And he had a completely different outlook than the original medical examiner did, with where it actually, the evidence matched what Melissa was telling the investigators back when she was first interrogated in 2006, 2007.
Yeah. And even right here, I've got part of a Texas Rangers testimony who was part of the conviction, talking about how he knew right then and there that she did it, but the technique that he used has zero foundation in scientific ways of telling somebody did it. Yeah, it's a. Do you happen to know? And this is just an honest question. Did she have private representation?
I don't believe so. I don't believe she did. I don't know for a fact, but I don't think she did. I think that Mr. Gilman was court appointed.
Yeah, and so often and sadly that is the case. That's nothing, I guess. On occasion, whenever that is the case, I guess it is something against the court appointed lawyers, but
you know, and I don't want to give court appointed lawyers a bad reputation.
No, there are some great ones out there.
Yes. Yes. I know some great who have more trial experience than I do, but that's just where they want to dedicate their time and their energy. And you'll hear in Harris County, we have a split system. We have a public defender's office, just like a district attorney's office, but we also have attorneys, defense attorneys who are in business for themselves that also take court appointments. So, there's two ways to gain a public defender here in Harris County.
Yeah. Now, with that being said, as a defense attorney, how do you approach a case like this? How do you come into that? It's such a sensitive situation to begin with. And once again, by the time you might get a hold of them, or by the time a family member may have called you to come help them and retained your services, this has already gone down the pipe. I've spent my night in jail. I know what that's like. And when you're number one detained before you ever see anybody, hers is a little bit different situation, but it could be hours before you get that phone call, before you get the opportunity of that contact.
I think that's why it's important for us to always remind the public that you have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney. So I see these folks get interrogated for hours on end, and it's just exhausting. And I'm thinking, why didn't you stop? Why didn't you just stop? And we have that power. But at the time, you know, because we're brought up to respect law enforcement and to cooperate, and especially if you didn't do anything wrong, you feel like, well, if I just tell them my side of the story. But it is so important to remember you have the right to remain silent and to ask for a lawyer. Once you ask for a lawyer, they cannot ask you any more questions. Ask for a lawyer. And that is the end of that. And then you get to my office, you know, or I come to the jail to visit you, and we discuss in a privileged conversation everything that happened. And then I get the discovery from the state, including CPS records. And so then I have the time to comb through everything, the recordings from the children's interviews, the recordings from CPS interviews, the records from CPS school records, eyewitnesses, family members, and then, of course, the scientific evidence. So, you know, the government can allot funds for us to get a defense expert to review the state's expert work. So that means we can hire someone to look at the medical examiner's autopsy findings and see if that opinion is consistent with the state's expert or inconsistent and why. You know, so all of that work needs to be done. And then there's some other judgment calls. So, you know, if the family member says one of the children can testify to this, and then the attorney says, I don't think it's a good idea to put that child on the stand and elicit that testimony. Well, that's a legal strategy, a choice that that attorney made. It may not have been in her best interest to not put that child on the stand. So, sure. You know, those are things that have to be.
Well, because you have the right to not incriminate yourself.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes people don't want children to get on the stand because they're afraid of the trauma that might, you know, being. But a good prosecutor is not going to beat up a child in front of the jury. That's going to turn the jury off, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, it must be hard as a defense attorney to walk into a situation like this and have to start literally sifting through the weeds and finding out as quickly as possible what the truth of the situation actually is.
Well, that's our job, though, and that's what we're employed to do. And also, it would be malpractice if I didn't ask the court for funds for an investigator to help me to weed through all of this and get witness interviews and to get the records and to go through it.
Sure.
A case of this magnitude, especially when you're facing death, you need the proper legal team. And you don't necessarily have to have celebrity money to have a dream team. If you have a lawyer who knows how to obtain sufficient funds from the government to at least get to a fair trial up against what the state's resources have.
Yeah. And that being said, you've actually defended not this exact kind of case, but you have defended death row cases before, have you not?
As second chair, but not as first chair. Yeah.
Well, and those cases can sometimes stretch on for years.
The one that I did in 2006 was 9 months in federal court.
Wow.
And at the end of it, we were fighting to save our client from the death penalty. In the end, the jury gave him life instead of the death penalty. And he looked right straight at me and he said, I'd rather be put to death than spend the rest of my life behind bars.
Wow. Wow.
And so I talked to a very well-known and highly respected parole attorney, Texas parole attorney, this morning. We were talking about another case, and I mentioned this one. And I said, what are your thoughts? And, of course, he and I feel the same way about the death penalty. You know, it is harder to have life behind prison bars than to be sentenced to death, especially if you're guilty, right? But he and I both, you know, agree that the death penalty is probably not something that we need to have. And for me, it's because I've seen people falsely convicted of things they didn't do. And once that person is put to death, that's the end of that, and there's no reversing that. And you and I, you know, I'm a conservative Republican. I have been my whole life. I probably always will be. And so I find it a little inconsistent that we argue against abortion, but we argue for the death penalty. So that is something that, you know, is not reconciled for me. But I just don't believe in the death penalty, and primarily because I have seen so many cases where someone who was actually innocent was convicted.
That's
and
right.
Once they're put to death, there's no turning back the clock on that. And I don't want to play God.
I would venture a guess, and I'm not gonna Google stalk it right now, but I guarantee you if you Googled the statistic, it would probably be at least one every couple years that you hear about an exoneration from a death row or from a life sentence, something along those lines, because of more modern evidence and evidentiary chains and things like that.
Especially DNA. DNA was a game changer.
Yeah, precisely. And
but when I asked him, you know, what he thinks is going to happen in this case, you know, despite Kim Kardashian getting involved and even the Mexican government getting involved, and they're not big proponents of death penalty, and all of the publicity through the Hulu special and all the publicity that Melissa has been able to get, drive up through her case, the Innocence Project, her conviction was reversed on appeal, and then they reversed it and put it back in place, and she ran out of appeals, and then they set the execution date for this Wednesday, April 27th, and the well-known, well-respected parole attorney that I was talking to, who lives in Huntsville, said, they're going to go forward. And it may not be on Wednesday, but he doesn't see this getting reversed completely.
Yeah, I sadly don't see a case of, at least I don't see a case being mounted for any kind of exoneration by the governor or anything like that, you know, like last minute step in. Hopefully there's 32 Republican members of the House, 8 Republican senators, there's an 103 members total of Texas legislature, that are behind this lady and behind the petition to, withdraw her case and withdraw this, at the least withdraw execution, you know.
You know, one of the first things that I thought of when I first started watching the Hulu special was they show Harlingen, Texas. And I was born and raised in Texas. My uncle was a Democratic district court judge down in McAllen, Texas for many, many years. So I'm very familiar with the Valley. I went to law school with a lot of folks that came from the Valley.
Yep.
And the first thing I thought was, this is 2007 in Cameron County in the Valley, which you would think would have been Democratic and liberal. And they not only convicted, but they found for the death penalty. And I just thought that was, but of course, like you mentioned, some of those jurors are now coming back saying, had I known then what I know now, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, exactly. My decision would have been 180 degrees from what it was. And that's just it. This is one of those cases, that if somebody takes it on to the prosecution of the death penalty, they are searching for a headline.
He made headlines one way or another, especially after he got sentenced to 13 years in federal penitentiary.
Well, yeah, once you get found for your own action, that's your own doing there. I can see this as a definite inside of an ad commercial for somebody's campaign, you know, as a talking point. And that's what's horrible about it. So as a defense attorney, what do you do to, I guess, inform your client, aside from be quiet? You can't really stress that one enough. How do you go about, because switching from this into the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard stuff, how do you use the media to your advantage? Because obviously the DA was using the media and headlines and things like that to push this case and push the conviction. So,
you know, every case is different, and I typically try to stay away from the media until the case is finished. But there are times when I feel like my client's not getting a fair shake in the media. Yeah. And if it's going to be that newsworthy, then the jurors, the potential jurors that are coming for trial, we need to at least start trial on an even footing.
Yeah.
You know, from what they've heard out in the news media before they step into the courtroom. Now, then, of course, you're going to ask the potential jurors, you know, who's heard anything about this. And but some cases, you can't shield all of the potential jurors from hearing about the case before they get there. And sometimes that's why you have to have the change of venue, which runs its own risks in and of itself. I've seen cases where people ask for a change of venue and it actually worked against them instead of in their favor.
Sure, you can lose sympathetic jurors because they don't come from the same jury pool as where the person lives.
Right. But as far as the Johnny Depp and Ms. Heard spectacle in the media right now, I was actually surprised how much coverage it's getting during the day. It's almost like a soap opera.
Well, and, you know, I guess because we had you on discussing the world of court during COVID,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of live stream court, stuff like at least privately live stream. But this takes it beyond court TV, which was really introduced in the Menendez brothers case
right.
just before OJ. Just before all that happened. And I mean, we were just out of high school, when that stuff happened. And
Greta Van Susteren.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. Like there were people that made their career off covering stuff on court TV. And it became like 24/7 coverage of court cases.
Yeah.
And I remember the kerfuffle of, Do cameras belong in the courtroom? And there's one thing to cameras belonging in the courtroom. There we've of course talked about the horrendous things that can happen when the media is pushing a paradigm and you as a defense attorney have to fight that. But and how to fight, like, yes, I heard about it and this is what I know. And it's like, whoa, that's horrible because none of that's true. but man,
well, you know,
this is like literally live streamed on social media.
Yeah. And of course, he's used to having cameras on him. He's used to putting on a show. He's used
sure.
to being
the both,
the, you know, the central actor. But I was really impressed with the poker face that she's able to maintain while he was testifying and he's going into all these details that are not flattering for her. She pretty much held a poker face in her composure the entire time. And that was pretty impressive. But at the end of the day, it's very difficult to prove, defamation.
Oh.
And I understand his complaint that because of her allegations and this article that she apparently didn't even name him in, he lost business and it's important for him not only to set the record straight for his business, but also for his children so that his children know that, you know, but,
sure.
you know, Johnny Depp was sober for a period of time. And then this stuff apparently started happening when he lost his sobriety. And I don't know if he's regained his sobriety since all of these allegations or not, but
yeah, let's hope,
from a substance abuse recovery standpoint, this chaos is all, this drama is all because of that unhealthy situation that was created when he lost his sobriety. And, you know, we always say water seeks its own level. So wherever you are, you know, on the spectrum of energy, that's what you're attracting. So, you know, if he was in a downward spiraling, you know, spiraling downward from using or drinking, and then that's what he attracts, then you're just going to create more and more drama. But who wants to put that on display for the entire world, including your children? If the point was that you wanted your children to know that you're not an abuser, at what risk? Because they're learning other things they probably didn't know, right? So
yeah.
You got to weigh the pros and cons. And at the end of the day, do I think he's going to be successful in his claim? Probably not, because it's a very high burden to be able to meet on the plaintiff's side. And then she countersued. So then she's got claims that she's the plaintiff on as well. I think in the end, this is going to be an ego struggle that is a wash for both of them. and it's going to be a hickey on both of their resumes, their careers, and
we'll
view them. And I don't think that we're going to think of Mr. Depp the same in Pirates of the Caribbean 6 or whatever number we're on at this point.
I think he actively refused it. I think I saw that headline actually, but, which I wouldn't doubt after all this. But right. As far as the leveraging of social media, and I would have to assume that it's coming from the prosecution side to bring camera and not just cameras, but live social media streaming into the equation. You know,
usually it's they have to ask the judge, and then it's usually a decision the judge makes, and there's an order, and the judge puts certain parameters in the order, and then that all the media has to follow. You know, and usually one channel will have the lead, the main source, you know, be the lead, and then you know, but I just think in the day of streaming where people are sitting at their desktop and they get bored and they're on their lunch break and they want to zoom in and see what's going on in the Johnny Depp trial. You know, it's just, it's so easy now. And everything is on camera now for the good and for the bad.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, we've definitely had that conversation, about how to protect yourself and how to make sure certain things don't end up on social media in your life, that kind of stuff. What can people do? I know we only have you for another few minutes here, but what can people do to start protecting themselves in relationships like that, and hopefully avoid the courtroom, avoid these horrible, horrible consequences?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, just from a legal standpoint, you know, I never will plead a client guilty to something they didn't do. On the other hand, you have to weigh the options of trial versus taking a plea. Or, in Johnny Depp's case, the option of bringing on a lawsuit like this or shrugging it off and taking the hit, whatever it may have been. So I think the advice from counsel is very important. Some clients will listen and some won't. 2 weeks ago, I had a client who was looking at anywhere from no less than 15 to life in the penitentiary for something. And we didn't think they could prove the allegation, but I told the client that they could, at the end of trial, they could put an instruction to the jury for an attempted. They probably could prove attempted. And if that happened, he's looking at 5 to life going into probate. The offer was probation. It was, I believe 6 years probation going in. So we go to trial. They don't find him guilty on the charge. They find him guilty of the lesser attempted. And the judge was in charge of sentencing and the judge gave him 30 years. He's 48 years old. We have a lot on appeal that he's going to, you know, go ahead and work up the court through the appellate process. But had he listened to the advice of counsel, then he would be on probation right now and out in the world, right? That's what you hire lawyers for. So to lay out your options and to make a recommendation. But at the end of the day, they're the ones that have to make that choice, right? In Melissa's case, you know, her pretrial offer was 30 years, which sounds really intimidating for something that she didn't do. She was in a harder situation because, again, I don't plead clients to things that they did not do. Had maybe they worked up the case and presented to the prosecutor privately, where egos don't get involved, look, here are some weaknesses in your case. Can we do injury to a child or, you know, something that's not death penalty, you know, then those things could be worked out behind the scenes. I don't know how much negotiating was done between Johnny Depp and Ms. Heard over this situation before he made the choice to go public and have this trial that's probably not going to go in his favor because the standard is too high. You know, I don't know. I don't know what his lawyers told him, but I think that as far as protecting yourself in these types of relationships, you know, she made an article but didn't name him. But again, you know, how much drama do you want to engage in? It takes two people to argue. So some things blow up and are amplified because we give our attention to it. Whereas if he maybe had just decided to cut his losses and walk away, then he would be in a better footing today than he is right now.
Sure, sure. And like you said, had the client that you were talking about actively listened to counsel, he would be in a far, far different situation than facing 30 years and a long appeals process, which can swing your way. But once you're in an appeals process, you hope it does, you know. Decisions can be hard to be overturned and sometimes much harder to win than the initial case.
And the reason that you hire attorneys are because, you know, you're too close to the situation. So there's emotions and ego that are going to sway your perception and your opinion. Yeah. And that's why you need someone who's objective and neutral, who can step in and say to you, look, for your best interest, this is what I think you need to do. It is up to that person if they want to take that advice or not.
Well, and I was going to say just a minute ago, it must be hard for you. And not even an ego check, but just a professionalism check. 'Cause I know what it is for me to be on site and to advise a client. You know, I kind of do this for a living, and I wouldn't recommend doing it that way. Yeah, but we need to do it that way. Yeah, but it doesn't really, like, in my experience, it doesn't really work out well. Yeah, but it's got to be done this way. Oh, okay. And you just kind of have to, like, step two steps back and watch it fail. But do it the way that they want it done. And that must be like, hey, mine's just an event, man. Like, maybe a cue doesn't get hit right, you know, something like that. I can't imagine if you're trying to tell that to somebody about charges that they are facing for 30 years. And they,
you know,
don't want to listen.
Was...
And you have to continue, A, to be their lawyer, and B, to purposefully follow the course of defense that they want you to follow, despite your knowledge.
Yeah, it's hard, especially like one time I was a man with a doctorate degree hired me because his stepdaughter was making allegations that he had molested her. And he presented so well and so professional. And I just thought, oh, you know, I believe him until I got into the state's evidence. And then when I realized that the six-year-old girl was not making this up, that he had exposure, I asked him to take a plea deal. He was not going to, because one, in those types of allegations, it is very difficult to get a client to admit that that is actually true, that something like that did happen, right? And in this case, you know, they were offering only penitentiary time to a doctorate who never had been in trouble before. He's not going to just volunteer to go on into penitentiary, especially on that type of allegation. So he was 25 to life, yeah, the way that they had him charged. The pretrial offer was 12 years on a aggravated sexual assault of a child. The charge that he went to trial on, 25 to life, that is 25 years at a minimum, day for day, no probation, no parole, no early, nothing. It is 25 to life, day for day. On the 12 aggravated, he would have only had to do about 80% of that time, 75% of that time before he could have paroled, right? So we went to trial against my advice. And in the end, the jury found him guilty of the lesser included aggravated sexual assault of a child. And they only gave him the minimum, which was 5 years. And he paroled out in, I think, a little more than three. So he actually beat the pretrial offer by going to trial. It didn't work out the way that he wanted it to, but we did better than what they were offering. So there's those circumstances too, but he was not going to take my advice at all. And, it was very difficult. Wow. Actually, that was one of the last, child sex allegations that I ever took, because, I never wanted to be in a situation again where I felt like I had to defend somebody that actually was guilty of what they were accused of. And that was very hard.
Yeah. And I mean, I can see where a lot of people might not have a crisis of conscience on that, because yes, by all constitutional law, everybody is due a defense. But yeah, that's a crisis of conscience moment there, where it's like, can I even put myself in a position to defend this person, knowing on every bit of piece of paper and evidence that I have before me that they are ragingly guilty.
Yeah, well, I'm not the jury, but I felt like it would probably end up that way. So, but you know, I still I really appreciate being able to defend those that trust me and they come to me and ask for help. And there's a lot of good things that we are actually doing in people's lives. You know, there are a lot of folks that I help get sober who are charged with drug or DWIs or even domestic violence can sometimes be stem from substance abuse, like in Johnny Depp's case, you know.
Sure.
So there's a lot of good that we're doing on this side, despite what folks really think about criminal defense lawyers.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. A good criminal defense lawyer does do like you. They actively get involved with the person themselves. They get them the help that they need. That's part of the whole, rehabilitation of the person, you know, even just treating the case. So it's great to hear that there are still good folks like you out there properly representing people. Thank you so much for always coming on the show, JL.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. Whenever I see things like this in the headlines, it's always something that, you know, I'm not a proponent of the death penalty, and I don't think that I'm a huge Batman fan, but dude, I don't think in all reality that wreaking vengeance or anything like that is actual justice, in any way, shape, or form. And by all statistics, it costs us more money to execute somebody than it does to imprison them for life. So, just put them in there for life. And quit putting people in there for things that you should just get them some help for, you know.
And there is power in prayer. So absolutely. I do ask that folks pray for Melissa Lucio as Wednesday's date is approaching.
Fastly approaching. It is, man, like I just quivered inside even thinking about it. Just thinking about the possibility. It's heart-wrenching and it's heartbreaking to think about. Let everybody know where they can go to get help for themselves, for their family. Should they run afoul of anything, JL, where can they go to get a hold of you? Where can they go to reach you? What is your website? Everything else.
Thanks. Yeah, my website is jlcarpenterlaw.com, jlcarpenterlaw.com. And our phone number is 713-201-6767. My kids joke. They say, if you go to jail, call JL.
Heck yeah. Absolutely. Your number is on my speed dial and for much more than just guesswork. I don't intend to go to jail ever again in my life, but I didn't intend to go to jail that night either, JL. I don't think anybody ever actually intends to go to jail. It just kind of creeps up on you that evening.
It happens.
Absolutely. So, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your expertise and all that you do and all that you share on our show, as always. Please do hold the line while we close things out. While you're online checking everything out from JL Carpenter and jlcarpenterlaw.com, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. That is where you can find all of the episodes. That is where you can find our event calendar down at the bottom of the homepage, where you can check out things like the Bigfoot Road Show coming up in Mineola. Click the date there and it will actively take you there to buy tickets on Eventbrite. Stop on by, support them, buy shirts, buy swag. Check out the Curious Realm store, curiousrealm.com/store. Check out the live shows coming up from Mineola and elsewhere, curiousrealm.com/live. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. Bye-bye. Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the knowledge vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.